Let's open our Bibles to Ezra chapter 10. Ezra chapter 10. We are at the end of the book of Ezra. Very simple book to outline. The first six chapters are about what? The rebuilding of the temple. And then chapters 7 through 10 are about what? All right, Ezra comes back and he's going to be teaching the law and confronting a problem. Now, Ezra is described as a scribe. In chapter 7 and verse 10, for Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to practice it and to teach his statutes and ordinances in Israel. All right, he wanted to study, to practice, and to teach. And we've emphasized that when we're talking about the Word of God, that's a pretty good game plan, to study, to practice, and to teach. Now, when Ezra returns, he has an immediate problem. In chapter 9, what is this immediate problem that they are dealing with? All right, intermarriage with people of the land. And that represented a real slide in attitude between chapter 4 and chapter 9. In chapter 4, as they began to build, the people of the land came and said, we want to help you build. And what'd they say? No, this is ours. They maintained the separation between themselves and the people of the land. But by the time we get to chapter 9, a lot of years have gone by, and that separation is no longer there. The biggest evidence of that is the fact that they had intermarried, but we saw last week that there was a little bit more to it than that. In solving the problem in chapter 10, they put away the wives and they put away the children of those wives. And that was a tough thing to do. Very difficult, but they did it. They came together to consider the matter. And this is kind of funny to even bring it up. But when they came together to consider the matter, what was the weather problem they were facing? It's raining. They're meeting in an open square. We just kind of brought up the idea last week that oftentimes when we're talking about biblical authority and what we can do, what we can't do, oftentimes the question of the church building comes up. Well, if you can have a church building, you can do this, you can do that, you can do the other. And sometimes we said, well, you know what? The church building really expedites the work of God. And sometimes you can't just meet out in the open air. Well, what do you see there? Can you meet out in the open air and get the work done? In the 10th chapter, they met there. It's raining. We can't do this. We're going to need more time to do this because of the weather. There are times where if you don't have the facility to get something done, you don't get it done very well. So they came up with an alternative plan to kind of get around this. And we also saw last week that it involved more than just their wives. In chapter 10 and verse 10, then Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, you've been unfaithful and have married foreign wives, adding to the guilt of Israel. Now, therefore, make confession to the Lord God of your fathers to do his will and separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives. They'd also gotten too close to the people of the land. They had not maintained the kind of separation that God expected. And last week we made application of this. Are we going to have to rub elbows with some of the people in the world? Yeah, otherwise you have to get out of the world. But is there a distance that's maintained by the child of God where he does not form the kind of union where he gets dragged down? That's a rhetorical question. Most of us know the answer is yes. There has to be that separation in the mind of the Christian between me and the world. There are some things that they do that I can't do. And some of the relationships that I might be tempted to form, I better not form. Now in chapter 10, verses 14 through 17, back to the rain problem. They come up with a solution to the rain problem. Let's read verses 14 through 17. Who would like to read that? I'll ask for a volunteer. Adam looked up at the wrong time. Adam, would you read that, please? 14 through 17 of chapter 10.
Let our vigil stand for the whole assembly. Let all in our cities who have taken foreign wives come at appointed times, and with them the elders, the judges of every city, until the fierce wrath of our God over this matter is turned away from us. Only Jonathan, the son of Asahel, and Jazeiah, son of Tibga, opposed this. And Meshulam and Shebethai, the Levites, and the returned exiles did so. Ezra the priest selected men, heads of the fathers' houses, according to their fathers' houses, each of them designated by name. On the first day of the 10th month, they sat down to examine the matter. And by the first day of the first month, they had come to the end of all men who had married foreign women.
Okay. The 14th verse, the way that reads is a little bit confusing. In your own words, what are they planning on doing? They decide that this is kind of a hard job to do, bad weather, bad time of year, and there's a lot of big problem here. So how are we going to handle this? Adam? We're going to take turns. The leaders are going to act like a court, and we are going to take turns. Now, that's what I see in it. And in 16 and 17, we can see that the leaders definitely acted like a court. In the 16th verse, but the exiles did so, and Ezra the priest selected men who were heads of the fathers' households for each of their fathers' households, all of them by name, so they convened on the first day of the 10th month to investigate. They convened to investigate. I don't know if you want to say this is like a court or like a grand jury, probably more like a grand jury, but they are convening to investigate what is going on. And in the 17th verse, they finished investigating by the first day of the first month. Okay, so if they're finished with it, by the first day of the first month, they finished it in time for what? The Passover. So they've kind of cleared the decks, they've got the issues taken care of, and they are ready for the Passover. Now, when we look at the end of it, you know, we're dealing with problem. How many are involved? Ken?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was simple a case, so they're going to go ahead with it because this is what the law of God says and everybody knows it. It mentioned there was some opposition, and it almost seems kind of funny. It's almost there, the way I'm looking at it, in a situation like this, you'd have thought a bunch of people would have been in an uproar. But if only a couple of people are in an uproar, does that mean pretty much everybody's on board? That's the way I'm seeing it. This is an indicator that there is some high-placed opposition, but almost everybody's on board because they know it's the thing to do. Yes.
Maybe they're not on board with the system that they decided to do. Maybe they are on board with the premise. Is that possible?
I suppose it is. I just don't know. All we know is that there is some opposition, and the opposition is not strong enough to put a halt to it. Myrtleene.
I was reading verse 15 as a little different because Jonathan and Josiah were supported by the Shulam Prince Shabbat.
Yeah. You had two guys and they had a little bit of support, Levites who were supporting them.
It wasn't like 2 to 2.
Oh, no. Those four were the opposition. Oh, if you were saying 2 to 2, no. These four just listed as the opposition. And when you have that large of a group and four are the opposition, that's not a lot of opposition. Now, when we come down to the 18th verse and we see how many are involved in this, it's really, in some ways, it's a little bit stunning. How many are involved in this? How many names? Did anybody count? See, this is the funny part. When we say this is a lot, what's a lot?
More than
four were involved in it, but they weren't opposing the action. I mean, they were guilty, but they weren't saying, no, we don't want to do this.
Megan remembers 117.
Yeah, that's about right. I was just counting off the top of my head, and I got a ballpark figure of a little over 100. Some of the wording is a little bit funny, but you come to the conclusion that there are a little over 100 names listed here. Now, when you look at chapter 10 and verse 13, but there are many people. It is the rainy season. We're not able to stand in the open, nor can the task be done in one or two days, for we have transgressed greatly in the matter. Okay, it's the rainy season. We can't do this in the rain. We don't have the facility for it, and it's a big problem. We've transgressed greatly. Okay, when you say transgress greatly, what do you mean? Okay, do you mean big guilt? We're really, really guilty? Or do you mean big numbers? I knew you were going to say that. Or yes. Well, this is the funny part. Yeah, we can see, boy, we got a lot of guilt here. And obviously they do. But when you say this is going to take time and the conditions aren't right, what you're kind of indicating is, well, from our point of view, this is kind of big numbers. Big problem here. And, you know, we look at this and, okay, this is a big problem, and we start reading the list, and we come up with about 100 names, a shade over 100. Now, you know, I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, well, maybe each name represents a clan, or, you know, maybe there's some way to swell this number, but that doesn't seem to be the case, because it kind of follows the same kind of procedure that they followed in the third chapter, where you have the priests were, the Levites were, the rest of the sons of Israel were. You know, so it really kind of looks here like we go through all this and we get 100 names. Think about this for a second. In 536, they return back from captivity. About how many people came back, according to Ezra? You don't have to get it. Just give me a to the thousand. About 42,000. About 42,000 people came back. This is 80 years later. Now, this is an assumption, and I realize it's a grand assumption, but I have to make the grand assumption to make the point. In 80 years, we're going to say they've grown a little bit. You know, you got two generations there. You can say, you know, they multiplied, had kids, and maybe, you know, some immigrated, came in. So we're going to say in 80 years, they went from 42,000 to 100,000. Now, I realize that sometimes populations don't increase. Sometimes they decrease. But in this situation, we're going to assume that it's gone up to 100,000 just to make my numbers work. If they've gone up to 100,000 and they find 100 guys, what does that represent? One in what? One in, am I right about that? 100 men out of 100,000? If we had 142,000, we'd have one in, what, 420? Does that sound like a lot to you? The way we tend to look at things today, that just doesn't sound like a lot to me. So why make such a big deal out of it like it's some serious thing? Yes. Wish you wouldn't ask me that. Polygamy was practiced in the world. I'm not real sure the Israelites were practicing it at this time. You know, I'm just not sure. There's some indications that sometimes they would get rid of one, take in another. You know, there are some guys that like to have another wife but don't want to pay for two of them, so we'll send one down the road and keep this new one. There's a lot of ways to play the game. But there are a couple of hands up. Doyce? A lot of them had died. But we're just assuming that in 80 years they had prospered some. And I know it's an assumption. This is just so we can play with the number. Whether we go with 1 in 420 or 1 in 1,000, to us that doesn't seem like such a big number. Why should we make such a big deal out of it?
Mm-hmm. And not repeating the past. They would come out of Babylonian captivity. Why are they going to Babylonian captivity? Because of all this, you know, intermarrying and idolatry and all that stuff, and the exact warnings that God had told them not to do. Don't mingle with people of land.
Yeah. We just had a meeting this weekend on the subject of what?
Leadership.
Subject of leadership. Who has really kind of taken the lead in this? The leaders. The princess said the leaders have been foremost in this sin. Now, if your leadership is foremost in it, what's going to happen? You are going to go in the wrong direction if your leadership goes in the wrong direction. This being the case, I mean, it really is kind of essential to get the bull by the horns and put a stop to this thing, because the leadership is taking them in the wrong direction. It might not seem like a huge number, but a lot of it has to do with who it is that's taking the lead in this. Adam. I would think so. I'm looking at this and shaking my head. I'm thinking that you only get 100, but they're looking pretty close. I mean, they are investigating the matter. And your experience with group investigations, if you get six guys together to consider something that should take 10 minutes might take what? You never know. But again, the point we're trying to make is this. We're not saying that there couldn't have been more involved. What we're saying is if this is the numbers we're looking at, it's like this has got to be stopped, because the ones who are actually taking the lead will take the country right down the drain. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6, the Apostle Paul said what? A little leaven. A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. I think this is the kind of situation we have here. The bigness of the problem might have as much to do with who's doing it as it is the actual numbers that are involved, but it is treated like a tremendously serious problem. And, I mean, we're going to jump on this right now. Boom. Can you think of other situations in the Scripture where a problem was jumped on, bang, because a point had to be made right now? Ananias and Sapphira comes to mind real quick. Did every Christian that sinned against God die in the first century? Aren't you kind of glad that we don't get killed on the spot? Why Ananias and Sapphira? You're at a point in time where Christians need to know that you're not going to put one over on God. Can you think of an Old Testament example? Korah's rebellion. There's another example. That's a good example. David and Bathsheba. Nadab and Abihu. Yeah. Nadab and Abihu. Achan. You think of Achan? What happened with Achan? One guy hides some stuff in a tent, and Israel loses a battle. Men die because of one guy. Why do you have to make the point? Sometimes, God saw to it that we are making the point here. You just have to step in sometimes and make the point that some things you're just not going to get away with. Mike. If you talk about also with Solomon, if you talk about leadership and the direction it takes a country, can you imagine how much influence Solomon had? How much influence his behavior had on the life of the nation? Somebody with that much status, that much respect, and he goes in that direction. Now, if you go back to the text, chapter 10, verse 44, the last verse in Ezra. All right. This is for funsies. You notice that this book kind of stops rather abruptly. All these had married foreign wives, and some of them had wives by whom they had children. All right, we're back to this point of emphasis. It's a tough deal. They put away the wives, they put away the children, and in this they show the difference between themselves and their fathers. Back prior to the captivity, were the people of God really willing to take any kind of rebuke and make any changes? No, but these people are, so there's a difference. Now, here's the funsy part. Of course, my idea of fun might be different from your idea of fun. I mean, this stops really abruptly. Can you think of another book in the Old Testament that starts, or rather stops, really abruptly? Jonah stops tremendously abruptly. Just bang, points made, stop right here. Can you think of any New Testament books that stop really abruptly? Acts stops pretty abruptly. Bang, right there. James stops pretty abruptly. There are times when they are writing that you're thinking, boy, from a literary style point of view, we might not have done it that way. Sometimes the Bible writers made their point and some like, okay, there's the point. Stop right there. Probably the best example of it is Jonah. You got to stop and think about Jonah to realize why did he stop where he did. Yes.
Do you think that any of those men that married the wives, that they converted those women? Are those guys being included in this category?
I have no idea. I can't maybe on that one. They're in a situation where they took people they were specifically told not to take, and the solution here is we're not going to do this. And they turned away from it. Any other comments?
What does put away mean?
Essentially, no. Kill, no. Yeah, we would use the term divorce, though sometimes phrases aren't exactly the same, but we would.
It sound like they let them stay there, though.
They probably sent them out. That would be my guess. Yeah. Any other comments?
We never even really see a ruling. It's just, you're right. I mean, it ends abruptly. We don't. Why are they talking about it for 3 months? What are they looking into? Are the women maybe
well, Adam was bringing this point up. Why would it take him so long to find 100 guys? When you're asking questions about people's background, if they're wanting to cover up, what do? They cover up. Sometimes it's just not easy. And all we can go, we go with what is written. Here's what we're going to do. And they did it. They may not have been. Sometimes people do oppose things of which they are not guilty because there is a relative or a son or a daughter involved. Other hands, yes. Go home. Go home. That would be my guess. Any other comments? Yes. I don't know. It's like we're going to take village at a time, and we've got the leaders here. And I don't know if the leaders answered for everybody or what. It's just things we don't know, but we know they investigated, and we found these 100 names. So this solves the problem. Paul.
I know that 25% of them were leaders, but the other point is there's no mention of women.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you also asked, like, the 42,000 that came back, was that just the men mentioned? And if we say 100,000, is that just men? Does that mean that if we really projected it out, there'd be more like 250,000 or a million? Some of this stuff we're kind of guessing at a little. The only point that I really wanted to make here is, based on the ones that were actually listed, it's not as big a number as you might have expected. And yet it was taken very seriously. Now, look one page over in your Bible to the book of Nehemiah. As we end the book of Ezra, Ezra is written when? 458. I mean, we are 78 years after the decree of Cyrus, so time has passed. Quite a bit of time is passing here, and we come down now to the time of Nehemiah. And there's a date on the screen, but for a second, try not to think about it. Just kind of think about this chronologically for a moment. With the book of Nehemiah, we get the last Old Testament historical view of the nation of Israel. I mean, this is end of the line. Last historical book. That's not to say it's the last book. You still have the prophet Malachi, but Malachi we list as a book of prophecy. We are thinking of the historical books. So we come to the last Old Testament historical book, and we're going to see the condition of the nation as we phase out of the Old Testament times. Think of the scope of the nation's history. You have the call of Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, and you have the captivity and the Exodus and the period of the judges and the period of the kings, the captivity, the restoration from captivity, and now at the end we have, kind of getting things on their feet. I mean, we're from beginning to end in Old Testament history. And to me, the fact that we've kind of come to the end of the history of the Jewish nation in the Old Testament here is what makes this final picture interesting to me. Here's Israel as we go into the 400 years. This is what they're going to be looking like at last glance. Now let's look at Nehemiah chapter 1 and let's read the first four verses. Tim, do you have that?
Thank you.
Okay, the first thing we want to notice is the date that we're looking at. In Ezra chapter 7 and verse 8, if you flip back there for just a moment. He came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which is the seventh year of the king. Okay, Ezra comes to Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes. Now we are looking at Nehemiah. And with Nehemiah, the action begins when? What year? 20th year. Nehemiah 1 and verse 1, we are in the 20th year of Artaxerxes. A 13-year difference. So if you look up here in 458, Ezra returns. 13 years later, Nehemiah is going to return. Now, just something to think about. For the last 13 years, okay, here's Ezra. Has he been on site for 13 years? I mean, has he been there? Unless he made a visit home. Because later on in the book of Nehemiah, when it's time to read the law, Ezra will be there and Ezra will read it. Let's consider that for 13 years, Ezra has been on site. Now, being the kind of man Ezra was, how would you have expected things to go? I mean, Ezra, is he an important dude? Big name? Capable person? Obviously. And he's been there. Now, with Ezra there, how would you naturally expect things to go? You would expect them to go well, wouldn't you? When you look at the book of Nehemiah, has it gone as well as you might have expected things to go? Evidently not, at least in some areas. We're going to find out that just because we've, you know, started teaching the law again doesn't necessarily get walls built, and it doesn't necessarily mean people don't fall into bad habits again. Think of the number 13 years. Is 13 years a sufficient period of time for things to get better and then deteriorate again? All right, think back on the last 13 years of your life. Is there anybody here that hasn't been on a roller coaster in the last 13 years? Life tends to be that way. The only point we get is that even though Ezra may have been on site for 13 years, that's sufficient time for things to get better and then possibly deteriorate a little bit. Another thing to keep in mind is, unless somebody has looked at a passage I haven't looked at, how old is Ezra? I don't know how old he is. But he's been around for 13 years. He didn't get 13 years younger during this time. He got 13 years older. If he started out fairly old and 13 years goes by, what happens to a person's energy as he gets older? Is it the same? Okay, those of you who are blessed with being 40 years old, who don't think you're blessed to be 40 years old, even though you are, 13 years from now when you're 53, will you feel the same? And then 13 years from that, when you're 66, you won't feel the same. It's possible that age might have something to do with Ezra's ability. We don't know. But what we do know is that things haven't quite gone as well as you might have wanted them to. Now, that doesn't mean they're total failures, but it's pretty clear that things haven't gone quite as well as you would have wanted them to go. So what you're trying to say is the guys that turned out to be opponents for Nehemiah probably were giving Ezra a bad time. Yeah, opposition definitely affects your ability to get something done. And we're going to find out that there's opposition there. And oh, by the way, just because you might be a very good teacher of the law, does that make you a good wall builder? Not necessarily. Now, as we go ahead here, Nehemiah really isn't described as a scribe, is he? What is he described as? The last part of verse 11, a little statement that probably should have been put into the second chapter, but it says, "Now I was cupbearer to the king." He is the king's cupbearer. What kind of position is cupbearer? It's a big position, a trusted position. Think of it this way, kind of like a Secret Service agent to the president. What's the Secret Service agent's job? Take a bullet. His job is to take the bullet. What is the cupbearer's job? Drink the poison, drink the Kool-Aid. If somebody gives you the poison Kool-Aid, the cupbearer is the one that's standing there, and he's the one that's going to be drinking it. So this is a highly trusted position that they're not going to give to just anybody. Now, when we read these first few verses, verses 1 through 4, think about the amount of concern that Ezra shows, and something that might make him a little better than some of us. We think of Nehemiah and his position as cupbearer. Okay, you're in the service of the Persian king. You're the cupbearer. In this world, how much better is your life likely to get than where you are now? You're the cupbearer to the Persian king. Where are you living? You're living in the palace. What are you eating? What the king eats? How do you think you're dressing? Is the king going to dress you in filthy rags so that you can stand before him and taste his food? The point being, if you're the cupbearer of the king, it's as good as it is ever going to get for you in this world, because they're not going to make you king. Except there is unless there's an act of God. So you got this guy named Nehemiah. Here he is, as good as it, as good as it gets. His life is as good as it gets. Now, if that's me, or maybe you, has anybody here ever reached the position where you say, man, life is as good as it gets right now? Nobody there yet? Say you get there, will you come to the realization that in this world, this is as good as it gets? I think I will walk away from that and go live in a place that's kind of torn down, backwards, filled with opposition, pain in the neck, hard-headed brethren, and take on a big building project that nobody's going to appreciate me for. How's that sound? I believe I'll pass. Somebody else can take that job. But this is what Nehemiah is going to do. He is going to walk away from as good as it gets to take on just a ridiculously difficult job. Now, why does he do that? Why do you sign up for something like that? My people, my home, and I mean, this is ridiculously simple. We probably shouldn't even have to state it. The realization, there are things in life more important than I am. True or not true? There are things in life that are more important than my personal comfort. There are things in life that are worth me coming down a notch or two to get something done.
I think he felt the way many of us feel. We just flat love our nation. And
yeah.
It pains us and we cry to see what's happening to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The feeling between Nehemiah and
Yeah. Patriot. It's not unusual to see people that love their nation, particularly when you come from a background like Nehemiah, where he has faith that there is a God in heaven that's orchestrating this and considers his nation to be very important. He understands that this is work of God kind of stuff, and he is willing to back, you know, come down from the palace, come down from the tower, and go get the work done, because, I mean, this is something that is dear to him. Now, verses 2 and 3, we have the condition of Jerusalem. Then Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. They said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire. Right, here's the condition of Jerusalem. Now, for just a second, think of the way they are looking at the Jews in Jerusalem. 100 years have passed. I mean, it's been right at 100 years from the decree of Cyrus. They've come back, they've rebuilt the temple, Ezra's come back, Nehemiah sees the condition. So, I mean, the return hasn't been yesterday. It's almost 100 years. And yet when they talk about those who are in Jerusalem, how do they refer to them? The Jews that had escaped. The Jews that had survived the captivity. It's been 100 years. It's like they are still looking at these people as a special group of people who are central to God's plan. Now, when you look at the condition they are in, what is their reputation? They are in what? They're in reproach. All right, what's that mean? You're in reproach. You are not highly favored by the people. You are pretty low on everybody's list. You're not on the A list. You're not on the B list. You might not even be on the C list. You might be on the D list. So they are in reproach. And what about the walls of the city? They're broken down. Now, there is some debate as to whether they had ever been rebuilt and somebody came in and broke them down again, or they just never rebuilt them. Just really doesn't matter that much, because they are broken down. And back then, if you are a major city and you don't have walls, what kind of condition are you in? You are vulnerable to anybody that goes by. There's a proverb says, a man who cannot control his spirit is like a city without walls. What was the proverb trying to say? Matter of fact, what did it say? If you don't have self-control, you're defenseless. The person with no self-control, there's no way he can stay out of trouble. Trouble's going to come to him, and he will have no defense because he has no self-control. Now, this is the situation Jerusalem's in. It essentially is a defenseless major city because the walls are broken down. And if you're one of the Jews still remaining behind, that's got to be tough. In the fourth verse, when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. If you're in Persia, you're the king's cupbearer. You're in the palace. And you hear that about Jerusalem. I mean, it's a mess. The people are reproached. The walls are broken down. Things are bad. What would you have hoped would have been true after 100 years? How would you want to envision Jerusalem after 100 years? Functioning city, temple rebuilt, everything going well, prospering, growing, everything's fine. There are no more problems. We're back on our feet, and it hasn't happened yet. And it's been 100 years almost. Now you sit there and you think about that. Haggai, the prophet Haggai, talked about the temple and said, the latter glory shall be greater than the former. Hasn't happened yet. Pardon me? I would debate that about whether or not that latter glory is greater than the former. Haggai 2 and verse 9. We'll stop right there. Now, next week, we come back and we're thinking about this. This is going to be the last historical view of the Jewish nation at the end of the Old Testament period. It's going to kind of set up the view going into 400 years.